And hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Andy Bombeck, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with a novel that I've been reading now for a couple weeks, titled Angus, Thongs, and Full Frontal Snogging, Confessions of Georgia Nicholson. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled The 11th Hour. And then it's Mommy Crumbs, Hide and Seek, Fliberty Gibbity Words, Young Shakespeare Chases Inspiration. And if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with The Ferris Wheel. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, which is titled The 11th Hour. Jules and Jim were born on the same day in the same town. Jim was born first. Jules arrived 2 minutes later. Jules and Jim soon became best friends. They liked the same things, and they played the same games. But Jim always took the lead. He was faster and stronger than Jules. Jules looked up to Jim, and Jim looked out for Jules. Everyone agreed Jules and Jim were an odd pair. Years passed, and nothing changed. Jules was always 2 minutes behind Jim, which caused him a lot of trouble. Everyone laughed at Jules except Jim. Life could have kept going on like this. 1914. But one day, a war began across the ocean somewhere in Europe. Because an Archduke and his wife were assassinated, Europe divided into two enemy camps: Germany, Russia, Austria-Hungary. And Canada was at war with Germany. Jules and Jim didn't understand all the news reports about treaties and alliances, but they understood that their country needed them. So the two friends enlisted in the army. They had to beat those German monsters. Jim was first in line for his pack. His uniform fit like a glove. Jules arrived 2 minutes too late. He got the leftovers. Jules and Jim had to go through rigorous training. "You're late, but Sergeant, it's not my fault." Jules quickly learned that orders were meant to be obeyed. Then, after months of training, they left for Europe. Jules showed up 2 minutes late. "This boat is full. You'll have to take that one. But that's an order." When they finally arrived in France, after more training in England, the Canadian soldiers received a jubilant welcome. They left for the front lines right away. Jules and Jim had imagined war to be full of epic battles and glorious charges. They were surprised to find muddy trenches surrounded by barbed wire instead. They saw action almost immediately. Huge shells fell like rain for hours. Then, after a lull, the Germans attacked on foot. But the Canadian soldiers pushed them back with machine guns. Then the Canadians began shelling the Germans. Before long, it was time for the Canadian attack. The soldiers knew running toward the enemy trenches was madness, but they had to follow orders. The attacks often ended in failure, and the soldiers, who were still alive, stumbled back to their trenches. They would hide there until the next attack, and then it would start all over again. Over the top and back, over the top and back. Life in the trenches was difficult, except for a few rare moments. And it shows them decorating a Christmas tree. The soldiers always had wet feet. They were covered with lice, and the trenches were full of rats. Jules became very good at catching them. There he is with a net. The soldiers started to look like cavemen. Sometimes they took German prisoners. And, to Jules and Jim's surprise, they didn't seem like monsters. They were kind of pitiful. Deep down, Jules and Jim envied the prisoners a bit, because for them, the war was over. But for the two friends, the slaughter continued, and weapons that were more and more terrible. Fighter planes, poison gas, tanks. The war was like a huge cauldron that kept devouring men. As the war dragged on, life away from the front lines became more and more difficult. Buy war bonds. Women had replaced men in many jobs, including at munitions factories, which were open around the clock. Handling the explosives turned their skin yellow. At the front, Jim was always the first to attack. Jules always followed 2 minutes behind, which was why Jim was decorated, while Jules got stuck doing chores, like peeling potatoes. But in spite of his medals, Jim was afraid, too. Sometimes at night, the two friends hugged each other. Sometimes they even cried as they talked about going home. The war lasted a long time. 1,564 days. Soldiers on both sides were exhausted. And back in Germany, hungry citizens were protesting against the war. Germany decided to stop fighting. On November 11, 1918, at 5 o'clock in the morning, the leaders of the Allies met the German leaders in a clearing near the front, where they signed the armistice. The fighting was supposed to stop right away, but they decided to wait until 11 o'clock to start the ceasefire, to give time for word to spread to the troops. 11, 11, 11. That meant the fighting would end at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. But meanwhile, on the battlefields, even though the armistice had been signed hours earlier, the fighting continued as if nothing had changed. Shortly before the ceasefire was set to begin, Jim and Jules were ordered to attack. As always, Jim went over the top first. Jules followed just in time to see Jim shot. It was 10:58, 2 minutes before the war ended. Jules did everything he could to save Jim, but his best friend died in his arms. It was the end of the war, and it was the end for Jim. Jules came home without his friend. He found it hard to live a normal life again. He couldn't stop thinking about Jim. Returning to civilian life was not easy. Jules tried all kinds of different jobs. In the end, he became a watchmaker. Jules' watches had one odd thing in common. They all ran 2 minutes slow. In memory of George Lawrence Price, the last Canadian soldier to die on November 11, 1918, he was killed at 10:58 a.m., 2 minutes before the armistice ended the First World War. And I dedicate this book to my grandfather, Michael Quiver, a Brenton farmer who loved life and animals. He often said he'd been through the entire war of 1418, which is how the First World War is often referred to in France. One day, when my mother was 8 years old, she asked her father how many Germans he had killed. My grandfather, who was normally a gentleman, replied sternly, "Never ask me this question again." He knew he was lucky to have escaped the war uninjured. However, some injuries are invisible. I would like to have known my grandfather. I would have asked him so many questions. Mommy Crumbs. When Mommy Crumbs was born, she was somebody's daughter, not a mother yet. Her parents called her Paula. The name Mommy Crumbs wouldn't come until much later. Paula often wished she could be a bird so that she could fly way up high over the mountaintops. Or what if she were a horse? Then she could run through the fields and feel the wind rippling gently through her hair. Or maybe a dolphin leaping and splashing through the seas, although this idea scared Paula a little, for she didn't know how to swim. When Paula grew up, she would cook for the entire family and also for Leon, an enormous old dog that had lived with her for many years. Everyone told her that she made the most delicious stews, and Leon always licked her hand in agreement. Paula loved cooking and eating. She loved it so much, she was always covered in breadcrumbs, which is why her family started calling her Mommy Crumbs. When Leon died, Mommy Crumbs was very sad. She kept a photograph of him in the kitchen. From time to time, she would kiss the picture and say, "I know you would have loved this stew." And it felt as if Leon was still there, licking her hand. This would make Mommy Crumbs smile. The years went by, and Mommy Crumbs became a grandmother. It was growing harder for her to reach the top shelves in the kitchen now. Every Sunday afternoon, her children and granddaughters would stop by to visit, and she would prepare them all a snack. And every time she stepped out of the kitchen, she was covered in breadcrumbs. Her granddaughters, Maria and Esperanza, would chant happily, "Mommy Crumbs! Mommy Crumbs!" And the whole family would laugh. One day, Maria and Esperanza thought up an idea so that their grandmother wouldn't be covered in breadcrumbs all the time. They went over to see her, taking something very special with them. When Mommy Crumbs opened the box, she smiled the biggest smile and even shed a tear of joy. For out of the box came a tiny baby chick. It hopped up onto Mommy Crumbs' chest and began gobbling up all the breadcrumbs. Mommy Crumbs was so happy, and she never found herself covered in breadcrumbs anymore. The baby chick always ate them all up. In time, the baby chick ate so many breadcrumbs, it grew larger than Mommy Crumbs herself. Mommy Crumbs was now very, very old. One day, Mommy Crumbs' children and granddaughters came by to visit her, and they found her sitting on top of the chick. Mommy Crumbs bid farewell to her family with a big smile on her face. "I will never be covered in breadcrumbs again. My sweet little chick eats them all. And not only that, it knows how to fly. I've always wanted to fly." And so Mommy Crumbs flew off on her chick, leaving a trail of scattered breadcrumbs in the air behind them. They looked just like stars. Her children and granddaughters miss her very much now. But every time they spot a breadcrumb somewhere, they know that Mommy Crumbs is always and will always be with them. hide and seek. Right on top of Shiverhawk Hill live children and pictures on the wall. Peeking out, woven gently by a midsummer moon, they spot something strange about their room. The twins have vanished from their picture frame. Where could they be? It's time for a game. Hide and seek, cries Percy. Lily says, whoopee. Let's find the twins, say the Plumsies, all three. Billy starts the countdown while the others look for clues. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. We're coming to find you. The friends run wild through the warm night air, hunting for white ribbons and long black hair. I've found the twins. Look up here, says Lily. And Percy says, those are just statues, silly. Then the splashing begins, and no one can see two clever girls hiding, quiet as can be. Squeezing out through the wall, they find their way, and there, in the wild of the woods, they play. Spying birds up above, spotting bugs down below, but no sign of the twins, so onward they go, until they arrive at the best place of all. Let's play here forever, the children call. Then all of a sudden, there's a sneeze from the bushes, some giggling, too. What could it be? Could it be you-know-who? Percy gasps, hops closer, and found you! The Shiverhawk children have found their two friends. My turn now, cheers Percy. Let's play it again. But just at that moment, the sky starts to tremble, to rumble and crash, and plip-plop, 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 a thunderbolt, a lightning flash. Oh no, we're so far from home, it's time to get back. So they slip and squelch back through their forest of fun, waving bye-bye birds, bye-bye bugs as they run. With muddy, wet ribbons and soggy black hair, the two lead their friends through the damp dawn air. The twins are first in, scrambling up to their room. Then it's Lily, then Billy, then the Plumsies, and soon. They call down to Percy, be quick, climb in. And the rain starts to soften, plip-plop, plip-plop, plip. The sun's on its way, a new day will begin. And so into their frames the children sneak, till the next time they play hide and seek. Flibberty gibbety words. Young Shakespeare chases inspiration. One morning, William opened his window and words flew in. My words, my thoughts, fly up, remain below. Words without thoughts never to heaven go. The words dangled over William's head, looking luscious and sweet. I'd like to catch those words, he thought. William tried to scoop them up, but they were flibberty-gibbety words that dipped and flipped and slipped through his fingers, glided downstairs, and leapt out the door. Vaulting over the wall, the wayward words played hide-and-seek in his neighbor's garden. See how the words embrace my lady's roses and climb her balcony? Said the young gardener. I will turn them into poems of love. These green-eyed words are jealous, said William. They are not made for courtship. What's in a name? That which we call a rose, by any other name, would smell as sweet. The words caught a gust of summer breeze and drifted into the street. They turned handsprings over cobblestones and darted between pushcarts. Parting is such sweet sorrow that I shall say good night till it be tomorrow. The king's three rose-cheeked daughters laughed as the words spun around their carriage wheels. I could use those strong words in my proclamations, said the old king. Those words are zany and madcap, said William. They are too frivolous for proclamations. They came through my window, vaulted over a wall, and hitched a ride on the wheels of your carriage. And now they are off to the river, the king cried. The words skated along the slippery banks and into the water. I will use these adventurous words in my songs to lift the sails, said the sailor. They are useless words and not made for work, said William. They came through my window, vaulted over a wall, took a turn on the old king's carriage, and now a storm might blow them out to sea. O brave new world, that has such people in it. A pair of fashionable twins stood nearby. Try calling the words and make them come to you. Please, good words, cried William, be well behaved and come back. But the words skipped across the water. Better a wilty fool than a foolish wit. William chased them across the bridge, past a farmhouse, through a graveyard, and into the majestic woods of Avon. And turn his merry note unto the sweet bird's throat. Come hither, come hither, come hither. The words danced onto the gnarled trunk of a greenwood's tree and were captured in a robin's song. William found the words simmering in a boiling pot, stirred by three old women. These words bubble, bubble, and are too much trouble, said the woman. Can I taste the words before I go, said William. They blew through my window, vaulted over a wall, took a turn on the old king's carriage, floated through the sailor's net, scrambled up a greenwood tree, were captured in a robin's song, and then dropped in your savory stew. Fair is foul, and foul is fair. Hover through the fog. These cold-hearted words are not for a little schoolboy, said the women. They tell of gloomy castles and sad secrets. They belong in a tale of ours. The women gave their brew another good stir and vanished into thin air, taking the words with them. Something wicked this way comes. William looked around the forest, lonely and lost for words. As William returned home, disheartened, he met the town peddler. You look like a boy who could use a few kind words, the peddler said. I had words. They blew in my window this morning and led me on a wild goose chase. They vaulted over a wall, took a turn on the old king's carriage, floated through the sailor's net, scrambled up a greenwood tree, were captured in a robin's song, and simmered into a witch's brew. Then they vanished. What's done is done. The words are gone. Words will come again to a boy like you, said the peddler. Next time, capture the words with this. The generous peddler handed William a paper and pen. To be or not to be, that is the question. That night, William opened his bedroom window and the words flew in. They were filled with memories of the eventful day. and a hint of a story. They tumbled onto William's desk, telling of leaky ships and far-off lands, kings and witches, roses and love letters. But this time, William did not chase them or try to scoop them up. Instead, he thought and imagined and finally whispered, "Please, good words, stay with me." Then he used the tip of his fine new pen to separate the humble jumble of words into lines and phrases, coaxing them onto the page to stay forever. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merrily players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts. Okay, I'm going to finish up the first half hour of today's program with a picture book titled The Ferris Wheel. Somewhere in the world, and somewhere else in the world, there is a boy and a girl. One morning, the boy's mama says, "Come on, time to get going. Say goodbye to Teddy. He will be here when you get home." One morning, the girl's papa says, "Come on, time to get going. Say goodbye to Fish. He will be with you in your heart." Leaving the house, Mama says, "Hold my hand." Leaving the house, Papa says, "Hold my hand." On the street, Mama says, "Be careful." On the street, Papa says, "Be careful." As they cross the road, Mama says, "Watch out." As they cross the road, Papa says, "Watch out." When they pass the candy store, Mama says, "No, dear, not before lunch." When they pass the candy store, Papa says, "No, dear, not anymore." And that is a bombed-out area. As they leave their neighborhood, Mama says, "Come here, you're getting wet." As they leave their city, Papa says, "Come here, you're getting wet." As they walk through the park, Mama says, "Watch your step." As they walk through the field, and there is a barbed wire fence, Papa says, "Watch your step." When they cross the river, Mama says, "Don't get too close to the edge." When they cross the river, and they're now on a little raft, because the bridge has been blown up, "Don't get too close to the edge." As they wait in the ticket line, Mama says, "Be patient. It'll be our turn soon." As they wait in the passport line, Papa says, "Be patient. It'll be our turn soon." As they get closer, Mama says, "We're almost there." As they get closer, Papa says, "We're almost there." And they're filling out new passports. "Wait for me," Mama says, as the boy runs through the gates, and it's a circus. "Wait for me," Papa says, as the girl runs through the gates, and it's the same circus. "This place is full of unfamiliar faces," says Mama. "This place is full of unfamiliar faces," says Papa. As they stand before the Ferris wheel, the children say, "Please, can we go?" Mama hesitates. Papa hesitates. And then, smiling, they follow the children to the ride. And the Ferris wheel turns and turns and turns, around and around, trading places, until everyone understands that they are all riding the same Ferris wheel. And at that moment, somewhere in the world, someone is saying, "Come on, time to get going," with a heart full of hope. And here's the author's note. My story is about the parallel journeys of two families from cities far apart, and a mother and son leaving their home for a better day, and a father and daughter leaving their home for a safer day. Each passed similar places, and both parents have similar concerns for their children. But their experiences and circumstances are tragically different. Living in a country located at the crossroads of East and West, I'm especially sensitive to the issues surrounding immigration. Almost everyone in Turkey has a story of displacement in their family. This has been a land of comers and goers for centuries. Political turmoil in this part of the world has made Turkey a place of sanctuary for some, at the same time that others must leave to find safety. This conflict inspired the Ferris Wheel, a story of going and coming, and of hope, longing, and empathy. It is a literally journey that we hope will inspire readers to have conversations about the dreams that we share and our universal right to seek safety. It is a story that encourages us all to find common ground, whether you are the one newly arriving in a strange land, leaving behind familiar places, loved ones, or a cherished pet, or the one who is already home. The fish in this story symbolizes the feeling of longing for the home left behind, as well as hope for the future. Both of these feelings grow stronger as we get farther away from home and closer to a new life. And we find peace in our destinations only when we find acceptance of our differences, acknowledgement of where we come from, and welcome from those who realize that while our experiences are different, we all share the same sky, no matter who we are or where we are. The world turns and turns until we trade places with each other, and who knows whose turn it will be to pack a bag. Luckily, there will always be people who are ready to open their arms. If this book inspires just one child to welcome newcomers with compassion and curiosity, then I will be content. Just one child is enough for me. That one child will make a lot of difference in the long run. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the novel that I've been reading now for a couple weeks, titled Angus Thongs and Full Frontal Snogging, Confessions of Georgia Nicholson. I am a facsimile of a sham of a fax of a person. Georgia Nicholson's life is far from simple. Her cat, Angus, is the size of a small Labrador. Her three-year-old sister may have peed somewhere in her room, and her best friend, Jazz, thinks she looks like an alien just because she accidentally shaved off her eyebrows. Enter the sex god. This just might turn out to be the most fabity fab year ever. Okay, last week, Georgia and her friend Jazz went to the store where Tom works. Tom is the boy that Jazz has a crush on. While talking to Tom's handsome older brother showed up, who Georgia has labeled the sex god. And that's where I left off last week. Sunday, September the 6th, 8 a.m. When I walked into the kitchen, Dad dropped his cup in an hilarious, not display of surprise, that I was up so early. What happened, George? Has your bed caught fire? Are you feverish? It's not midday yet. Why are you up? I said, I came down for a cup of hot water, if that's okay. Very cleansing for the system. I must avoid a spot attack at all cost. Mom said, well, I'm off. Libby, give your big sister a kiss before we go. Libby gave me a big smacking kiss which was nice, but a bit on the porridge side. Still, I must get on. 10 a.m. I have completed the Cosmo Yoga plan for inner peace and confidence. I vow to get up an hour before school and go through the 12 positions of sun worship. I feel great and 2 or 3 feet taller. The sex god will not be able to resist the new, confident, radiant, womanly me. 2 p.m. Face mask done and milk bath taken. I must try and get the milk stains off the bath towel somehow. It already smells a bit sour. Jazz rang. She thinks we should track Tom tomorrow after school. Tom, what is he to me? 4 p.m. Just discovered that Libby has used the last of my sanitary towels to make hammocks for her dolls. 4:30 p.m. She has also used all of my Starker's foundation cream on her panda. Its head is entirely beige now. 5 p.m. I have no other foundation or money. I may have to kill her. 5:15 p.m. No, peace. Inner peace. 8 p.m. Ah, early to bed, early to rise. 9:30 p.m. Woke with a start. Thought it might be time to get up. Midnight. Should I wear my pencil skirt or not tomorrow? Monday, September the 7th, 8:30 a.m. Overslept and had to race to get a lift to Jazz's with my dad. No time for yoga or makeup. Oh well, I'll start tomorrow. God alone knows how the Dalai Lama copes on a daily basis. He must get up at dawn. Actually, I read somewhere that he does get up at dawn. 8:45 a.m. Jazz and I running like loonies up the hill to the school gate. I thought my head was going to explode. I was so red, and also, I just remembered I hadn't got my beret on. I could see Hawkeye at the school gate, so no time for the sausage method. I just rammed it on my head. Bugger, bugger, pant, pant. As we ran up to the gate, I catapulted into the sex god. He looked divine in his uniform. He was with his mates, having a laugh and just strolling coolly along. He looked at me and said, "You're keen. I could have died." 9 a.m. My only hope is that A, he didn't recognize me, and B, if he did recognize me, he likes the flushed, stupid idiot look in a girl. 9:35 a.m. After assembly, I popped into the loo and looked in the mirror. Worst fears confirmed. I am Mrs. Ugly. Small, swollen eyes, hair plastered to my skull, huge red nose. I look like a tomato in a school uniform. Well, that is that then. 4 p.m., the bell. Thank God. Now I can go home and kill myself. 7 p.m., in bed, Uncle Eddie says there is an unseen force at work of which we have no comprehension. Well, if there is, why is it picking on me? Tuesday, September the 8th, 8 a.m. Still no time to do my yoga. Not that it matters anymore. I did manage to do the sausage barrette and the lip gloss and the concealer. Nothing like shutting the stable door and tarting up the horse after it's bolted. 8:20 a.m. Nice and early with Jazz. This time, we are both ready. We walked up the hill, really chatting and laughing, waving at friends, well, actually waving at anyone, just to give the impression that we are really popular. We walked slowly at the end bit leading up to the gate, and although there was the usual crush of Foxwood boys oogling, there was no sign of Tom or S.G., sex god. 9:30 a.m. I'd forgotten how utterly crap school is. In assembly, there was a bit of chatting going on before Slim took the stage. And do you know what she said? She said, "Settle, girls, settle," like we were a bunch of pigeons or something. She's already started her fascist regime by saying she has been told that some girls were not wearing their berets as they arrived at school. She would like the other girls to set an example to the younger ones rather than the other way around. Is this what my life is now? Talking about berets while a sex god strolls around on the planet? I felt like shouting out in front of assembly, "Get a life! Slim, in fact, get two. There's enough of you." But Hawkeye was looking at me. I know she was thinking about the locust. She's always watching me. She's like a stoat. I don't think I can stand much more of this, and it's only 9:30. 5 p.m. What a nightmare. Jazz, Ellen, Jules, and I are not allowed to sit together at the back. I cannot believe it. Instead, I have been placed next to nauseating Pamela Green. It is more than flesh and blood can stand. Nauseating P. Green is so boring. It makes you want to slit your wrist just looking at her. Plus, Hawkeye is our form teacher. Quelle horreur and triple murder. And it's physics, last thing Friday afternoon. What is the point? Wednesday, September the 9th, 8:40 a.m. I have perfected putting a little bit of mascara on so that you can't tell I have got any on. No sign of the lads. 1 p.m. After lunch, Allison Peters and Jackie Matthews came by. They were smoking, and I must say they are common girls. But obviously, I must not say it to them, as I do not want a duffing up or chewing gum in my tennis shoes. Jackie said, "We're doing a new thing tomorrow, so you can all come and meet us in 5C form room tomorrow after second lunch. Cheers. Thanks a lot. Good night." It is, of course, strictly forbidden to be in school after second lunch. I sense something. What is it? Oh, yes, it's my first poor conduct mark coming along. 6 p.m. Is my life over? Is this all there is? Downstairs, my parents are laughing at something, and in the other room, Libby is playing with her dolls. I can hear her talking to them. It's so sad that she is so young and she doesn't know the sadness that lies ahead. That's what is so sad. I can hear her little voice murmuring. What is she saying? Oh, it's poor Georgia, poor Georgia. Thursday, September the 10th, 5 p.m. Boring day at school, then home to my even more boring home life. I wanted to debrief with Jazz, but she had to go to the dentist. Jackie and Allison's proposed extravaganza was put off this lunchtime. Thank the Lord. The message got passed along at assembly that Jackie was off sick. She has started taking sickies very early on in the term. Anyway, we are spared whatever they had in mind for a few days. I think they take drugs, horse tranquilizers probably. Tuesday, September the 18th, 4:30 p.m. Absolutely no sign of S.G. However, I have found out some gossip because Katie Stedman's parents no, SG's parents, from some NAF card club, the really old go-to. Apparently, he's called Robbie Jennings. His parents, Mr. and Mrs. Jennings, own the shop, the so-called green grocer come delicatessen, according to Jazz. I don't normally like Katie Stedman that much. She's okay. But I get the impression she thinks I am a bit on the superficial side. She's bloody tall, I'll say that for her, and her hair is nice, but she sort of tries too hard. She puts her hand up in class, for instance, properly, I mean. She doesn't do the putting your hand up, but leaving it all floppy at the end of your arm, so it just flaps around. This is the sign of someone who is obliged to put their hand up because that is the fascist way, but isn't really putting their hand up. I have taken to putting my hand up and pointing one finger forward, you know, like at football matches when everyone points at a chubby player and chants, "Who ate all the pies?" But as usual, any sign of humor is stamped down in this place. Hawkeye said, "Georgia, if you are too tired to put your hand up properly, perhaps you should go to bed earlier. Or perhaps a few thousand lines might strengthen your wrist." I may try it out on Herr Campier. We have him for German and physics, which is the only bright spot in this hellhole. He has the double comedy value of being both German and the only male teacher in an all-girls school. 8 p.m., listening to classical music. I thought it might be soothing, but it's really irritating and has no proper tune. 8.05 p.m., I love life. Jazz has just phoned to say we've been invited to a party at Katie Stedman's, and Katie has asked Tom and Robbie. Yes! I must have done a good job of being nice to Katie. What on earth can I wear? Emergency, emergency. It's only a couple of weeks away. 8.10 p.m. I'd better do my yoga. 8.15 p.m. I'd better start applying face masks now. 8.20 p.m. I wonder if I slept with a peg on my nose, like Amy in Little Women. It would make it smaller. Why couldn't Mom choose someone with a normal-sized hooter to marry? 8.30 p.m., I ask Mom why she married Dad. He was bowling with Uncle Eddie, I ask you. She thought for a bit, and then she said, "He makes me laugh." He makes her laugh? He makes her laugh? Well, Bart Simpson makes me laugh, but I'm not going to marry him. Midnight. Ha, 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 ha. Monday, September 21st, 8 a.m., 11 days to the party. Tuesday, September 22nd, 9:30 a.m. Someone farted in assembly this morning. I suspect nauseating pea green. Whoever it was really loud, and during the silence, we were having to think about all the poor people. And it wasn't just a quick one. It was a knee trembler. Jazz, Ellen, Julia, and me were shaking with laughter. Well, everyone was. I was laughing for most of the day, and now my stomach hurts. Thursday, September 24th, 5:30 p.m., in bed. I'm absolutely frozen. I may have TB. Honestly, Miss Stamp is obviously a sex pervert, as well as clearly being a lesbian. Why else would anyone make girls run around in sports knickers hitting a ball with sticks? She calls it hockey. I call it the sick wanderings of a sick mind. If I miss this party because of Miss Stamp, she will die. Friday, September 25th, 10 a.m. A sighting at last. On the way to school, we saw Tom. He actually stopped to chat. He said, "Hi, having fun?" I said, "Yes. What could be more fun than being with sadistic loonies for 8 hours every day?" He laughed and said directly to Jazz, "Are you going to Katie's party?" Jazz went all pink and white, then sort of pinky white, apart from the tip of her nose, which remained red. I must remember to tell her what she looked like. She managed to reply and said, "Well, I look forward to seeing you there." Jazz was ecstatic. "Did you hear what he said?" "Yes." "He said, 'Are you going to Katie's party?'" "Yes." "He said, 'Well, I look forward to seeing you there.'" "Yes." "He said, 'I look forward to seeing you there.'" We've been through this. "He said, 'I look forward to seeing you there.'" To me. "He said, 'You,' because he meant me." Jazz, "Yes? Will you shut up now?" 5 p.m. She didn't, though. Herr Keimer didn't take us for physics, as he has a cold. Double damn. "When am I going to have any fun? Sacre bleu." Saturday, September 26th, 10 a.m. Went for a moody autumn walk with Libby in her pushchair. She was singing, "I am the queen. Oh, I am the queen." She wouldn't take off the fairy wings that I had made for her. It was a nightmare getting her into the pushchair. The clouds were scudding across the sky, but it was quite sunny and crisp. I cheered up enough to join in the singing with Libby. We were both yelling, "I am the queen! Oh, I am the queen!" And that's when he got out of a red mini, Robbie, the SG. He saw me and said, "Oh, hello. We've met before, haven't we?" I smiled brilliantly, trying to do it without making my nose spread out over all of my face. It's a question of relaxing the mouth, putting the tongue behind the back teeth, but slightly flaring the nostrils so that they don't go wild. He looked at me a bit oddly. "Apples?" I said wittily. "Oh, yeah," he said. "The shop, you and your friend." He smiled again. He was dreamy when he smiled. He bent down to Libby, who, true to form, gave him one of her scary, "I am a crazy child" looks. She said, "I am the queen." And he said, "Are you?" Oh, he's so lovely to children. Then Libby said, "Yes, I am the queen, and Georgia did a big poo this morning." I couldn't believe it. He could not believe it. Nobody could believe it. It was unbelievable. That's why. He stood up quickly, and I said, well, I'd better be going. And he said, "Yes, see you later." And I thought, "Think Sharon Stone, think Sharon Stone." So I said, "Yes, well, I'll probably see you at Katie's party." And he said, "No, I'm not going. I'm doing something else that night." 7 p.m., Georgia did a big poo. 7:05 p.m., "No, I'm not going. I'm doing something else that night." 7:06 p.m., "Does life get any worse?" 8 p.m., "Yes, it does. Dad has just put his head round the door to say, 'James is popping over tomorrow. We thought we'd all go to Stammer Park for the day.'" Sunday, September 27th, 10 p.m., "James tried to kiss me. It was disgusting. He's my cousin. It's incest. I can't even think about it or I'll be sick." Elak. 10:05 p.m. "It was in my room after a horrible day spent tramping around a bloody park. How old do they think I am? They made me go on a seesaw. I, of course, snagged my new tights. So, a summary of my lovely day out is, I snagged my tights, then I was attacked by my cousin. Perfectamondo in my room. 10:07 p.m. When we got back, James and me were listening to records and reading old joke books, and suddenly he switched off the light and said, shall we play Tickly Bears? Tickly Bears. We used to play that when we were about five. One person would be the Tickly Bear, and they would chase the other person and tickle them, and that's it. I was so shocked, and also couldn't see a thing in the dark, that I just sort of went, na-na-na-na-na, and then he said, gotcha, and started tickling me. It was the most embarrassing thing, but it didn't end there. A sort of wet thing touched my face near my nose. I leaped up like a salmon and stumbled for the light. James sort of stood up, and then he picked up a joke book and started reading it. So I did as well. Then he got taken home by my dad. The wet thing on my nose incident was never mentioned, like the leg. I don't think I can stand much more of this. Monday, September 28th, 11 a.m. At break, I told Jazz and Jules everything. They went, oh, lack. That's truly disgusting. Your cousin? That is sad. Jules said that she had actually seen her brother's How's Your Father quite often. She said, it's quite nice, really, like a mouse. She lives in a world of her own, thank God. Well, bless us, Tiny Tim, one and all, I say. And unfortunately, this is where I'm going to have to stop today because we are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the novel Angus, Thongs, and Full Frontal Snogging. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.